Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Understanding extremist mindsets. In today's rapidly changing world, understanding extremist mindsets has become increasingly critical. As the landscape of radicalization evolves, extremist ideologies are propagated through sophisticated online networks and social media platforms, making it easier for these groups to recruit and radicalize individuals across diverse geographies. The rise of digital communication has not only expanded the reach of extremist propaganda, but has also introduced new challenges in monitoring and countering these threats. Psychologically, radicalization often involves a combination of personal grievances, social alienation, and ideological indoctrination. Individuals may be drawn to extremist groups in search for belonging or purpose, especially in contexts marked by social, political instability or conflict. The interplay between identity crisis and extremist narratives can significantly impact one's susceptibility to radicalization. Currently, violent extremism manifested through terrorist groups poses a significant threat globally, affecting regions from Asia and the Middle East to Africa, Europe, the US, and Canada. According to the Canadian government, there are 77 Islamist extremist terrorist groups, including the Afghan and Pakistani Taliban, listed as terrorist organizations. The National Strategy on Countering Radicalization to Violence in Canada plays a crucial role in safeguarding Canadians from violence, hatred, and intolerance. In this episode, we will delve into the complex world of extremist mindsets. We will explore how ideologies, religion, social, and political influences in digital media impact radicalization, and discuss effective strategies for countering and de-radicalizing extremists. I am Ahrar Ramispour, a former lecturer at Kabul University and president of World Anti-Extremism Network, an organization based in Toronto, Canada. Joining me today is Dr. Casey Bob, a senior fellow with the MacDonald Laurier Institute, MLI, based in Ottawa, Canada. Dr. Bob has made significant academic contributions to several institutions and universities both in Canada and abroad. His research on terrorism and the future of warfare has been published in journals and books in Canada, the US, and Europe. Additionally, his commentary on terrorism-related issues has been sought by many of the world's largest news outlets, including CNN, BBC, Fox News, CTC News, and countless others. Welcome, Dr. Casey Bob, to this episode of WINS Podcast. I would like to start with the question that, what are the most critical psychological and sociopolitical factors that drive individuals toward extremist ideologies? And how can understanding these factors inform more effective prevention and intervention strategies?
So that's an excellent question. And first, I want to start by thanking you and your colleagues for the work that you're doing. It is incredibly valuable, and you're making a tremendous contribution at a time when it is very needed. It has always been needed, the work that you're doing, but over the last several months, and particularly since October 7th, in Canada, we have seen a real surge in not just extremist thinking and extremist rhetoric, but extremist activities and activities that have been planned and thwarted, which could have killed untold people. So again, you're doing really fantastic work, and I am happy to be here with you today. To answer your question, I mean, the main thing that comes to mind, the main variable or factor that comes to mind is culture. You know, our brains are potentially wired in such a way that we know to love our own group and to sort of look upon others with a sense of skepticism, maybe even dislike. There's something there. There could even be something, you know, in terms of us being hardwired to be that way. And really, in that sense, it it is this tribal mentality, this ability for human beings to determine who's in and who's out. That is, to me, is one of the most, if not the most sort of fundamental element that leads individuals towards extremism and their ability to take that factor, which I've just mentioned, and sort of supercharge it to ensure that they sympathize less with people, with other groups, with outsiders, with people they now perceive to be adversaries or enemies, people who have a way of life or a way of thinking that is antithetical to theirs. And fundamentally, when we empathize less with someone, it's easier to kill them. And certain groups of individuals, certain ideologies appear to be exceptionally good at decreasing empathy for quote unquote the others. And we see this with jihadist culture. It's very pronounced. We see this with right-wing extremist groups as well, and everybody in between. So to me, when we think of extremism, what leads people to extremism and what enables them to pursue such sort of radical extremist thinking, it is their ability to dehumanize individuals for a cause. And so that would be ultimately the simplest way of answering you.
Thank you, Dr. Casey, for this. I think you touched upon very key points. Sympathizing less with others. This is a very key point that you have mentioned. If you a little bit elaborate about the rule of conflict zones and also authoritarian regimes, how these two issues contributing to this phenomenon, to the mindset of extremist groups?
Well, you ask a great question, and as I would expect you to do, you ask challenging questions. You know, all of this is it's hard sometimes to wrap our head around, right? Like it's when you're not an extremist and you don't harbor radical views, it is, you know, we're talking about a way of thinking that is quite foreign to us. But when you bring in things like authoritarian regimes and conflict zones, you are increasing the likelihood of extremist thinking, radical thinking. And that's because when people are suffering, when people are under the thumb of another individual or another group or way of life or ideology, that can then end up accelerating their grievances, heightening their grievances. And, you know, one thing that all groups have in common, all extremist groups have in common, is the fact that they all have some sort of grievance that they purport to be sort of fighting for. And these grievances, some of them are real. Some of them are very real. Some of them are perceived. Some of them are fabricated. And some of them, of course, many of them fall somewhere in between. And so when you're dealing with, you know, autocrats and conflict zones, whether that's in Gaza or Syria or Afghanistan, you're going to have people who start to think in such a way that it reflects their living conditions. They're looking for a way out. They're looking for answers, and they're looking for someone to blame. And again, that goes back to my initial point, which was othering people. You can put people, you can compartmentalize individuals and other groups into people who are with you and people who are against you. And when you're in conflict zones, or you're subjugated because of, you know, authoritarian leaders or dictators, these things can really be heightened.
I think, yeah, you mentioned good points. If you also elaborate a little bit about some examples of these authoritarian regimes, for instance, how you see the rule of those states, they are supporting these radical ideas or extremist groups, for instance, Iran. Iran is one of those countries that supporting somehow these groups, these illegal armed groups, these radical groups from Yemen to Syria to Lebanon, and fueling the ongoing somehow instability in that region. If you go further to my region, to Afghanistan, to South Asia, you can see other causes, other root causes for this extremist group that was somehow a kind of the legacy of the Cold War, that Afghan Mujahideen, establishment of religious madrasas, you know, bringing all these Arab fighters into the conflict in that part of the world, and then, you know, expanded to civil war, and then Taliban, first time of Taliban, now the second round of Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These all, you know, groups and incidents or political agenda or these authoritarian regimes in the world, they are somehow fueling, as you mentioned, or supporting the radical groups and extremist groups in the world. What do you think about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what we're talking about here, in, to a certain degree, is like generational extremist thinking. You know, an uncomfortable thing to think about and talk about. It's almost taboo to talk about. You know, I've said this before when it comes to Gaza and the question of, you know, Palestinians and Israelis and you know, peace prospects, that, you know, an entire multiple generations of Palestinians have been radicalized. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you love them or hate them, or you're somewhere in between, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and many other leaders have said that, you know, for there to be a peace, there needs to be a generational process of de-radicalization. Unfortunately, though, you know, whether you're dealing with, you know, groups like the Taliban, or you're dealing with Hamas or Hezbollah or even Fatah, you know, you're, a lot of these groups depend on extremist thinking, and they depend on instability, and they depend on the fight and the quote unquote, the struggle. And so when you take away these sorts of elements, all of these elements depend on one another to a certain degree. And a lot of these individuals, whether they're autocrats or they're, you know, some part of a dictatorial party regime, you know, it is, they need these things. They depend on these things to maintain power. And for dictators and for, you know, these nefarious individuals who unfortunately run large swaths of the Middle East and elsewhere, they thrive on extremist thinking. And so you're really onto something here. I mean, this could be you're making me think about another PhD dissertation.
Very important point. That's multiple generation involved on these radical groups, multiple generation involved on these kind of conflicts. That is a very true point. Also, the reason you have mentioned, these authoritarian regimes, they are keeping these radical groups, they are supporting these extremist groups to maintain their power. That is exactly what people thinking about. Yes, this is a very important point. Dr. Casey, given your extensive work in countering extremist mindsets, particularly in the wake of the tragic events of October 7th last year, as committed by the Hamas terrorist group, how do you assess the current situation? What steps can be taken to prevent such incidents in the future? Additionally, what role can Canada play in these efforts?
Now, to be clear, you are asking specifically about the situation in Israel.
Yes.
I tend to think about things, you know, oftentimes when I talk to people, whether it's, you know, individuals in the media, or it's, you know, family or friends or other people working in the field, even they'll bring up the question of time. And it is natural, given our, for biological reasons, that we think about time in specific ways. We think about time in relatively, typically short chunks. And when I say short, I mean, short to me is 10, 20 years, 25 years. What I tend to do is I think about the totality of situations, the history of situations, and that informs the way that I think about time. And so for me, I think the situation on the whole is not going away anytime soon. It's not going to go away within my lifetime. It could certainly improve. But again, going back to your earlier question and what I mentioned before, we need to think about things on a much longer term horizon. This could be a few hundred years. It could be 100 yeah. years. So human beings, we like things to happen fast, and we're in a rush for things to happen. But it's important to remind people that the people of Israel, Jews in the region, have been fighting for autonomy and fighting for their sovereignty for thousands of years. And it's not going to stop anytime soon with government intervention or multilateral cooperation. Those things might alleviate some of the more acute dilemmas and truly catastrophic elements of this conflict that are currently unfolding. But over the long term, I mean, you need to have a process wherein there's fundamentally a societal de-radicalization. And in my view, governments, including Canada and others, need to start having more realistic conversations about these issues. If we don't pull the Band-Aid off and start talking about things in such a way that they reflect the realities on the ground, then we will just continually kick this down the road over and over again. We need to be honest with ourselves and be honest with each other. And only then can we really start thinking about what needs to happen for there to be a peace in place.
Thank you, Dr. Casey. I would like to ask the last question, not the least. It is just a question, this key question for me also as an Afghan resettled here in Canada. I think considering Canada's increasing diversity due to immigration in the presence of extremist ideologies among some new arrivals, such as the recent incidents, maybe you heard about that, in Toronto where a Taliban flag was raised. At a protest, there was Arab community protesting about Palestine, and there was someone, he was raising the Taliban's flag. And also there was another case recently, probably you heard through media, the two ISIS members, a father and his son, both of them were arrested here in Toronto. Somehow, how we can say that what strategies should be employed to ensure the safety and security of citizens? What role can Canada play in addressing these challenges?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, again, I'll just say it. Most people in positions of power and influence aren't saying it. We need to stop with the extremely liberal immigration policies that we have. Yeah. Immigration is a fundamental part of Canada's way of life, of our identity. Immigration is really a massive injection of capital when it comes to our economy. And when it comes to the diversity, the wonderful diversity that we have in this country, we're one of the most diverse nations in the world. But there are limits, and there must be limits. I mean, to have the immigration levels that we have and the targets that we have, absent the appropriate infrastructure in place to screen individuals, is leading to evidently a very destabilizing situation here in the country, as so much so that it has garnered international attention. At the same time, we also need to start doing things socially and culturally that, again, may be uncomfortable to talk about, but we need to signal to individuals who are coming to Canada that you're coming to Canada, we're happy to have you here. We wouldn't be what we are without you. But there are things that come with that. This is not an open country in the sense that you can just come here and make, you know, plant your flag in the ground for whatever, you know, group or ideology you believe in that is tethered to a part of the world that you've abandoned, that you've been forced from, that you've left. And so, you know, I talked about this recently on social media, that we have so many individuals here who, from the luxuries of the West, from the luxuries of our country, bemoan and, you know, obsess over what they perceive to be grievances of a distant homeland that perhaps they long for, but they do so in such a way that, you know, it's like they've come here and they're going to keep fighting for the same things and believing in the same things that they believed in Gaza or in Syria or in Iraq or wherever. Those things need to be parked when you come here, and we don't do a good enough job as a people, as a nation, to say that, to signal that to individuals. You know, it's a very acute issue here, and you need to have much stronger government screening. You need to have less individuals coming in. We are a notoriously porous country for letting, you know, a wide range of unsavory individuals come in here. And as a people, we need to make it clear that we actually do have a Canadian way of life. We actually do have things that we believe in that are Canadian. We have a way of life that should be respected and embraced when you come here. And if you harbor extremist sympathies, this cannot be the country for you. And so that's, you know, sort of my thinking in a nutshell. But of course, this is a very complex and a complicated issue that you raise. So there's no necessarily easy answer, unfortunately.
Thank you, Dr. Casey, for your very valuable points. Indeed, the beauty of Canada is on its tolerance, multiculturalism, pluralistic society, diversity. All these points are very important and key to a multicultural society. And people who are coming or immigrating here to Canada, they have to respect the rule of law, human rights, diversity, and tolerance in the society. People who are coming with their dirty ideas, extremist ideas, and causing trouble of society here, should not be acceptable. I totally agree with your points. Thank you once again for joining us in today's podcast of WINS. I hope to have you again in our gatherings, workshops, seminars, and will benefit from your comprehensive ideas. Thank you so much, Dr. Casey.
Thank you so much for having me. I hope to speak with you again.